Now entering Nerdist.com.
Big Pop Fun. It's time for another episode of Big Pop Fun with Tom Wilson. Join Tom as he talks to the artists, writers, performers, and personalities that affect... that he can talk into being on the show. Here's Tom.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Big Pop Fun Podcast with Tom Wilson. I am Tom Wilson. You are lovely, large, and yet oddly, completely unathletic host of this fabulous, fabulous sleigh ride of enchantment and wonder as we all look at my physique and say, well, no surprise, he's unathletic. Actually, I guess I was reminded of that because I was on the phone with a friend the other day who reminded me, and I forgot this because now my legs are shot, but reminded me that for the nerds, I was like the fastest one. So there's that. That is the, you know, the pinnacle of my athletic career and experience, that was a friend remembered that one time all of us nerds, for whatever reason, you know, we put down our backpacks or our plays or our paints or our clay. We put down all of our things and we had a foot race. And apparently I was the fastest nerd. So, which surprised everyone. He just said, yeah, for my physical size at the time, they just thought I would be lumbering. I was not lumbering. I was actually fast for one of those dudes. Just to warn you that for a very brief window, at one point, I was faster than I look. And that window has closed. So now I can tell you very safely, I'm far slower even than I look, and I look slow. But still, I wouldn't mess with me because I think that I could hang onto one of your legs like a boat anchor. It would be hard because I think I'm pretty powerful in that way. Like if you started to fight me, I would just like fall to the ground and grab one of your legs. Like when a little kid like sits on your foot, I would do that, but I'm so like you couldn't walk away. You couldn't definitely play a game. You couldn't sit on a chair, fold your legs over and like do that. Wee, like I was playing horsey with me on your leg. No, you actually couldn't move and you'd have a hard time like, you know, pulling my fingers off from her because I could grip hard and I'll just be like holding on. So you'll have to get a few people to coax me off with treats or something, bacon or I don't know, something like that, a grilled cheese sandwich. And I'd be, oh, I'll grab that. And then when I grab the sandwich, you know, go for the fingers and get me off there because I can be very determined and impossible to get off of your leg. Not that I've ever tried that, but I'm trying to imagine myself in a kind of what way I would be actually physically imposing and not just large, but actually hollow inside, like a, you know, like a, the Trojan librarian, very huge on the outside and on the inside, just wheels, levers, and a small librarian with a sweater vest turning dials. In Las Vegas many, many years ago, I was there with several comedians and we had called over to the Smothers Brothers show to see if a bunch of guys at the Dunes Hotel working at the Comedy Store show could see the Smothers Brothers. The Smothers Brothers, you know, managers or whoever was managing the room, were gracious enough to extend an invitation. Say, you guys, if you finish your show, you come on over here. We're going to sit you down and you enjoy the Smothers Brothers. And we'll see even if you can meet Tom and Dick after the show. So we go there, and I freely admit, we were a bunch of young comics in a booth in Las Vegas. I was very excited to see the Smothers Brothers But we were wise guys. We were being smart, Alex. And some of us, not me, I was getting in trouble for being with a smart Alex. I wasn't the biggest smart Alex. There were a couple guys who it was a little much. But I guess my point is the opening act for the Smothers Brothers was one of those, I don't know where they were from. Let's say Czechoslovakia. Well, there's no such thing as Czechoslovakia anymore. But back then, it was one of those Czechoslovakian teeterboard families where they have the board that's like a seesaw kind of a thing. And the gigantic uncles from the Ukraine or somewhere, they jump on the board. And then young Yorgi, who's 7 years old or something, he flies into the air and lands on another family member's shoulders. Ta-da! They had all kinds of balancing routines and everything. Anyway, my point being, when they open the curtains and a bunch of guys from Eastern Europe in glittery outfits come out on the stage to the music, and they're doing these poses. And we all look at each other, and I must admit, even I was at my smart alecky best. We were ready to keep just looking at each other with these eyes. Oh, brother, Czechoslovakian teeterboard family. Opening for the Smothers Brothers. And then this family just blew the roof off the place. You couldn't deny they were absolutely unbelievable. They had many of them, and they were, well, they did a lot of the teeterboard stuff. And then, you know, the one uncle, the biggest heavy guy, he would pop up, and then some one of the lighter guys, but let's say he's a 17-year-old kid, he flies into the air, double backflip, lands on the shoulders of his uncle, and then the girl goes up, and then a smaller girl goes up, and then it's impossible. They're almost at the roof, the ceiling of the theater. And then young Yorgi comes onto the teeterboard, and he's going to have to go up far. So it's not just one uncle, you know, Uncle Grostock, whatever his name, you know, it's two big men who go up high off a ladder, and they both jump off the ladder, land on this thing, bang, and Yorgi is doing backflips. I don't know how many he did. Backflip, 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 all the way up the line and lands on his sister's shoulder. I don't know what it was, but it seemed like the kid was 30 feet in the air. Standing ovation. We stood up. We went crazy. We cheered for these people because they were absolutely unbelievable. They practiced their whole lives just in balance and teeterboards and the gymnastics and everything, and we were thrilled. And anyway, and of course, and then the Smothers Brothers came out and were absolutely fantastic. They blew the roof off the place. They were absolutely unbelievable. The Smothers Brothers are still, I'm a huge fan of the Smothers Brothers and Tom Smothers. I've worked with Tom on the set of The Informant, and he's a great guy. But their ability at performing comedy is just second to none, and they were great. My point is, though, about the teeterboard family, we were so taken by them. And I think all live performers just love the unusual. They love to see something that they haven't seen on stage. There's a great book by Ricky Jay, who's a wonderful performer and magician, called Learned Pigs and Fireproof Women. If you get a chance, look up that book. It's a very unusual book about the furthest outskirts of ways that people have performed for other people. And not so much freak shows, not so much people that you look at, but I mean acts like the human oven and the human fire hydrant and all, you know, l'epetomane, all sorts of acts. But anyway, Carrie Coleman is my guest this week, and Carrie is an actress of a very long resume, lots of experience. I mean, she's been the big Spider-Man movies. I mean, her resume is as long as your arm. She's a wonderful girl from Kentucky. The fascinating thing for me, and we talk about it, and so I don't want to give away too much, but she saw a very unusual and funny and thrilling act in Las Vegas. And the fascinating part to me was that she not only thought, boy, that's great, but she thought, boy, you know, I would love to do that. So, and she ended up doing it. So she did it. So listen up to my conversation. Hey, listen, this is one of those podcasts where I don't know how, but I made a mistake with my microphones, and I don't know. I'm still trying to figure it out. And sometimes the microphones aren't completely connected correctly, so we have good sound on this podcast. My apologies to Carrie, but not great sound. But Carrie's dog was also barking and wanted to be a part of the podcast, so I think that's why the dog actually messed up my microphone inputs. But I find Carrie a fascinating person. We're both on the upcoming MTV show Zack Stone is going to be Famous. I hope the thing actually airs, because I've been talking about it a while, and I think you should watch it because I think it's really good. So I hope it comes out on TV sometime. But please, I hope you enjoy my conversation with my friend Carrie Coleman.
5'2", eyes are blue, coochie, 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 coo. But Tom Wilson, the host of the Big Pop Fun Podcast, is significantly larger than that.
That is good. That is really good. Though I'm not wearing headphones.
Nice.
So I really have no idea. But I'm just saying, yeah, that's a lot better. Much closer to the microphone now. Nice. Thanks. Nice. Yeah. Carrie Coleman is my guest on the podcast. Is this the first podcast you've done?
This is the first podcast
is it really?
I've done. Yes. It is my virgin podcast.
Do you listen to them or anything? I mean, you know what they are.
Yes, I do.
Well, I'm not saying
that. I'm like that old.
Have you heard of this iPod thing that they have?
Oh, it's amazing. I have no idea.
Yes. Well, Carrie Coleman, the pride of Kentucky. Where in Kentucky, am I right?
You're right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sometimes with the southern states, you go for one because you just think, oh, she's
It's the area. Yes.
And you're wrong.
I am from what they call the tri-state area. So you had a three chance there. It's, you know, Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio. But I'm from Louisville.
Ohio gets to be in their tri-state area?
Yeah,
oh, sure, Cincinnati.
Cincinnati, right there, yeah.
Because Cincinnati's right. Cincinnati is actually Kentucky.
Well, you know, northern Kentucky.
Newport,
yes.
Kentucky is right across the river, like
now,
Camden,
now
New Jersey,
you're talking
and
Newport.
That's
yeah.
another tri-state area.
Yeah.
But New York gets two tri-state areas.
I know.
They get the Philadelphia is the tri-state area.
Yes.
And then New York.
Yeah, but you know what? New York does not get Kentuckiana, which is what they like to refer to Kentucky and Indiana, because it's Louisville and,
I guess you're right, because really, southern Indiana really is Kentucky.
Yes.
And southern Ohio really is Kentucky.
Yeah. The first time I told somebody that they actually say Kentuckiana weather, they were like, no, they don't really use that word. I'm like, yeah, of course they do. It's Kentuckiana. Yeah.
So did you, I mean, this childhood in Kentucky, was it rural? Was it urban? What kind of?
We, you know, I like to tell my kids the story that everybody likes to tell their kids about how, you know, horrible it was to get to the bus in the morning. But we lived in a newly developed subdivision, which was out in the middle of nowhere. I used to tell people when I was in high school to directions to my house. I said, you know, you drive down Shelbyville Road, and then when civilization drops off, you have about 5 more minutes, and then you'll hit our subdivision.
Oh, okay. Right?
Yeah. So, but when we were kids, we used to have to ride our bikes through this newly developed subdivision that was just the roads. That was just, you know, because they were putting in the houses. Now you go back there and it's just developed. There's crazy. The bus actually comes to my front door because we live on the corner. So I go out and harass the children and say, do you know what it used to be like?
Yeah.
My brother and I, because my youngest brother wasn't, of course, at school yet, but we used to get on our bikes, ride about a mile and a half up to the main road, which was Shelbyville Road, and then we would park our bikes under the tree at the farmhouse, right? And then get on the
park
bus.
Park our bikes under the tree at the
farmhouse.
Farmhouse.
Yeah,
wow.
I know. Yeah, and then
I hear a song being written by Shania Twain right now.
I know. Yeah. And then as the subdivision developed, right, the bus would come closer. So that's how we judged that, you know, that we were getting big enough. At some point, the bus came down the giant hill that we used to have to go up. And then it was just trudging through the snow and the dark and, you know, it's 6:30 in the morning and, you know, getting to the bottom of the hill. But yeah. Yeah.
So you were almost in the country.
Yes. We were country adjacent.
You were country adjacent.
Yes, yeah.
And was that fun?
It was fun. You know, I mean, we lived literally next to a farm, so it was a big, giant field next to our house. And, you know, my brothers were, well, they are still kind of the Dukes of Hazzard, the two of them. They would take their mini bikes and, I mean, their motorcycles and their all that stuff out there and just like go nuts. And they, you know, in the summertime, we would disappear in the morning and then come home at night. And we'd just go out and you could take your bikes and go exploring. And we found an old graveyard out there. And there was a creek. You could build stuff and actually go down the creek, you know, things like that.
So your brothers, you say, are Dukes of Hazzard. Yes. Are they really?
Yeah.
Do they talk? Do they speak with dialects from Kentucky?
Yeah, they kind of do.
They kind of do.
Yeah.
So how was this practiced when you decided to become an actress? Or did you talk with a Kentucky dialect when you were a kid?
You know,
and lose it? Or?
Well, here's the thing. We moved to Louisville when I was in about fourth grade. So before that, we were all over the place because my dad was in the Navy.
Oh.
So, and my parents are both from Ohio.
The Navy, and you based his family in Kentucky?
No, he got out of the Navy.
Oh, okay, sorry, because I didn't know.
We have a river,
there were
though.
Ships there.
We have a river.
Oh, okay. He was in the canoe Navy.
Yes, it was a very strong, you know, naval, yes, on the Ohio River thing. Anyway, so by the time I got there, I think my early accent thing had been formed. Uh-huh. But not so with my brothers, who, yeah, they
just decided to go for it.
Yeah, they kind of go.
By the General Lee. And
yeah, it's, well, the thing is, like, when I told Kyle, my husband, when I brought him home the first time to Kentucky, I said, look, there's only two things you need to know. I said, everyone is incredibly friendly. And so you don't feel like anyone's trying to get something from you, because that's your first reaction to how friendly everyone is in the South. You know, you think, whoa, wait, what's happening here? And the second thing is, never ride alone with either of my brothers in the car. So it's because
they'll just do donuts or something?
Well, they like to race. And especially if the two of them are trying to get someplace at the same time, yeah, forget about it. Yeah. It's not.
But Kentucky is a very beautiful state.
It is.
And I mean, I always liked it and everything. But the times that I've spent in Louisville and Lexington,
yes,
they're really great cities.
Yes.
Very, very nice people.
I like that you're name dropping cities in Kentucky. It's very nice.
I can identify two cities in Kentucky.
Yes.
I could probably even identify more than that.
All right.
But
okay.
But don't push me on it. But I've been all over your fine state.
Yes.
Not that you own it, but
it's okay. I'll claim it.
Were you putting on shows and stuff, like every young actress?
Oh, when
were
I was,
you doing a talent show?
Yes, the obnoxious thing. My cousins still write to me and say, we watch you on television and we think about all the horrible things that you made us do, which is, you know, which got you to where you are today.
You made them do?
Oh, yeah.
You were the director?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and the star. Yeah, the costumer and the set designer. Yeah. So.
And where was this? Your backyard?
We would go in my backyard, or when we met with my cousins, we'd meet at my grandparents' house, and they were in Ohio actually. So for all the big holidays and stuff, we'd go to my grandparents' house, and they had this amazing breezeway. You know, not many people know about a breezeway anymore. You know, it's a thing that goes between the main house and the garage, and it's kind of enclosed, but sometimes with just. You know, screens, but other times with those kind of windows that go up and down, you know, that with the lever, that kind mm-hmm. of thing, which is what the case was here. And my grandfather was a big electronics guy. He was one of those guys who could fix anything, take anything apart. He actually built the town fire engine, I think, at some point. So he had put together for us a big box that didn't do anything, but it had levers and dials on it and all kinds of stuff there. And so we would get together in this breezeway and we would play just, you know, crazy, like stranded naval ship, weather station, submarine, blah, blah, that kind of thing. So, you know, we'd play all these games for a certain amount of time. And then it was time for me to bring out my stash that I had brought, because I would bring all the costumes and the music because I had come up with this idea. And then I would force everyone into the basement and do this production, yes, that we would then perform for everyone. So, yeah.
Which they now look at as you putting them through this thing?
Yes.
They had fun.
It made them better people,
it
Tom.
It made them better people. And at school, were you in school plays and stuff?
You know, a little bit I was.
Now, where'd you go? You went to University of Kentucky?
Oh, no. That was much too highfalutin for me. I went to Eastern Kentucky University.
Oh, that's even better school, though.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
better
yeah.
academically.
Yes, it's in Richmond, Kentucky.
Eastern Kentucky University, what's their mascot? You don't even know the mascot of your own school? In your face, Coleman.
The colonels. We're the colonels.
The colonels.
Yes, the colonels.
And then they pass fried chicken or something?
But I, you know what? Can I tell you? This is a story. I met Colonel Sanders. Not many people can say that they've met Colonel Sanders.
You really met
the Colonel Sanders, and I spilled coffee all over
Not those. The fake ones, because it's like Santa. They sent out a lot of fake Colonel Sanders.
Yeah, no. I met the real Colonel Sanders, and I spilled coffee all over his white suit. Yeah.
Who was this?
I was a Sea Scout on the Ohio River.
your maritime stories of your father and yourself and Kentucky here, really.
It's pretty amazing for a state that we were landlocked. However, this is amazing.
You're going to be Sea Scout.
Oh, my God.
Girl Scouts with the cookies,
yeah.
I don't care.
Yeah.
I long for the sea.
It's true. No, my father was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary because he had been in the Navy, of course. So he was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary. And so he got us all involved in the Sea Scouts, which they had a big boat on the Ohio River, right?
I'm just fascinated with the Coast Guard Auxiliary still in Kentucky.
Yeah,
like, if they have a problem on the coast, that is a long drive.
In any place where there's water, you need the Coast Guard.
That's
just
true.
So you know.
That
so yes,
true.
You know, there's barge problem with barges. Come on.
You can have a barge problem.
Yes, see?
Who hasn't really
see?
Had a barge
really?
Problem on the Ohio River
yeah.
and needed the help of the Coast Guard Auxiliary? So
and they're happy when they show
they
up.
They certainly are.
So
you were in Sea Scouts, sorry.
I was in Sea Scouts. And I was also a Girl Scout, just you know. But so Sea Scouts would take girls and boys. And so we had this thing called this ship called the Zachary. It was not a ship. It was a boat on the river. A ship is on the ocean, just so you know.
Oh, thank you.
Called the Zachary Taylor. And every Derby week, you know, Derby's a big thing in Kentucky.
Of course.
They have the week leading up to the actual Derby, they have balloon races and they have, you know, hot air balloon races and music, bluegrass music festivals and things like that. Well, they also have what's called the Great Steamboat Race on the Ohio River. There's a steamboat called the Belle of Louisville from Louisville. And then there's some, I think it's called the Delta Queen from Cincinnati, comes down and then they race on the Ohio River, okay? Well, our boat, the Zachary Taylor, would go in the middle with a cannon on the bow of the boat that they allowed young teenagers to load and fire.
All right.
Yes. I look back on this now and I'm like, wow.
And the teenagers would really fire the cannon.
Oh, yeah. We loaded it and lit it and fired that cannon. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that would be the start of the race. So... the year that I was out on the high seas of the Ohio River with on the Zachary Taylor.
On the Zachary Taylor, the canoe named after a president.
Yes.
Always good.
Yes, yes, Zachary Taylor. Colonel Sanders came down to be the guest of honor on the boat because we were, of course, leading off the race of the steamboat races. So I met Colonel Sanders and we talked and he was a very lovely man. And we discussed his restaurant that was not too far from my house called the Colonel's Lady, which was a restaurant that he started for his wife, and
that was like a sit down restaurant
yes,
that he had.
Yes, it was like it's still there. It's an upscale,
like an upscale restaurant.
Yes, kind of thing. And so we talked about that, and I said, "Well, can I get you some coffee?" And he said, "I'd love some coffee." So I go to get some coffee, and I bring it to him. And just then, the boat lurched, and I spilled coffee all over Colonel Sanders' white suit. And and I stood there staring at him, and he kind of went, "Ugh," because he was old at the time too. He's like 100 then. And I thought, oh.
But
yeah.
He must have been deep. I mean, you're on a boat.
He was very, very sweet about it. He said, "Oh, no, it's fine, it's fine." And then before I left, he came and he gave me a big hug and he said, "Oh, you know, don't worry about spilling coffee on the colonel." Yeah.
But by the time he was 100, the colonel could have ordered a white suit to be ready at the dock.
Yeah, it's true.
I think he probably had two white suits in the back of a limo.
It's true. There you go. See?
But it's good that you met Colonel Sanders.
And I spilled coffee on him. Yeah.
I never did. I introduced biscuits at KFC in the national commercial, but...
That's okay.
What?
That's okay. It's fine, Tom. Not everyone can meet Colonel Sanders.
I certainly didn't spill coffee on his white suit.
You know, it's like the Mormons believe that, you know, you meet Jesus Christ in your life. Well, you know, me in Kentucky believe that if you're gifted, you meet Colonel Sanders. So
that's right.
So I have the aura of having met the colonel. So.
Wow. Maybe at the end of your life sometime, the colonel actually escorts you
through
the pearly gates in a coffee-stained
white
suit.
That would
be beautiful.
Yes.
Beautiful.
So, welcome.
So you, with the colonels of Eastern Kentucky University, where did you do shows then?
Yes.
Or when did you, you know, my thing is, what was the spark? When did you say, "Hey, I've done shows in the Breezeway, but I'm pretty good at this, and I think I'm going to look into doing it for money"?
You know, I started in college. I mean, I have my study was in business management, so that my father would pay for school. And then I took a minor in theater, so I just used
to
do all the plays.
Had he said he was not going to pay if you want to be an actor?
Not in so many words, but you know the silence was pretty much telling of it all. See, my mom was a dancer. My mom was a professional dancer before they got married. And
really, where was in Kentucky? Or?
No. She was in Cincinnati, and then she worked up in Boston at a club actually called it was called Blindstrumps, and it was one of those clubs where it was like a dinner club, and it was a thing, but everybody used to come through, like Sammy Davis Jr. and all those guys would come through, and Tony Bennett and everything. So she has this great book that has everyone they signed a picture for, because she was a dancer there. In fact, it was very funny, because this helped me win a bet one time. Years ago, back when I was, you know, young, and I was at the K-Rock Acoustic Christmas with a good friend of mine, because my first job when I came out here to Los Angeles, I was working temp, and then I got a temp job at what was called Polygram Records at the time. And so I met a bunch of music people. So anyway, so we're all backstage at the K-Rock Acoustic Christmas, and it was back when Tony Bennett had had a resurgence of being cool and hip, right? And so he was there. And everyone's like, oh, Tony Bennett's here, Tony Bennett's here. And it became a game of who could get closest to Tony Bennett. And I said, let me tell you something. I can get close to Tony Bennett, and I can give him a kiss on the cheek. And they're like, no way. He's got a whole entourage. You can't get close to Tony Bennett. I said, yes, I can. So the evening goes on, right? And we're all backstage, and whatever's happening, and everyone's around, and da da da, and this and that. And all of a sudden, around the corner comes the entourage of Tony Bennett with his men, and everyone goes, Gary. And they're placing side bets so that I can make it happen. So as he walks by, I said, excuse me, Mr. Bennett. And he says, yes. And I said, my mother met you. She danced with you at Blindstrom's in Boston. And he goes, he stops dead in his tracks. And he goes, Blindstrom's in Boston. Well, blah, blah, blah. And he does it the whole story. Well, da, da, da. And this man, I said, yes. And he comes over to me and he says, well, yeah, tell you what. I want you to tell your mother Merry Christmas from Tony Bennett. And he kisses me on the cheek. And I said, thank you, Mr. Bennett. And I kissed him back. And I turned around. And I was like, yes! Blindstrom's!
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. That's good stuff, man. Yeah. Tony Bennett and Colonel Sanders.
Yeah, come on. Let's name drop some more,
let's
baby.
Go.
Bring it on.
We need somebody at Eastern Kentucky University who came. But we're back to you deciding to become an actress. Because, Dad, you were studying business management.
Yes.
Which is exciting.
Isn't it? Yeah.
But were you in shows and still going, I think, was it occurring to you, or was it a lightning bolt?
No, it was always occurring to me. And so I was doing plays, and I just loved it. Loved the theater and the whole thing. And so, yeah, I was getting close to graduating, and I thought, if I don't do this now, you know, I mean, I won't do it. And so I told my dad, I said, I want to go out to Los Angeles. And he said, okay. So for my graduation present, he bought me a one-way ticket to Los Angeles. I had $800 to my name. I borrowed $400 from my grandmother, unbeknownst to my father, and two suitcases of stuff. And I knew somebody out here who I could stay with for a couple weeks. Mm-hmm. And that was it. I had been out here one time, actually two times maybe. That was it.
So far on the podcast, my only real can you top this is the amount of money that we had when we got to town. Because so far,
yeah,
I had around $620.
Nice.
So
right,
I have the lowest so far.
You do have the lowest, yeah.
Because I've had $900, $1,000. Right. You're at $800. You are the silver medalist.
I'll take it.
But you also know what it's like to come to a city with a little bit of money. And really no idea.
Oh, I was so...
What you're doing.
And you're at that... I was 20. I just turned 22. And that's a very dangerous age. Because 22, you really think like you know everything. You know what I mean? Because it just doesn't occur to you that you know nothing. And so I arrived here going, yeah, come on. I can survive. I know everything. And I just was, you know, I was from Kentucky. I was coming out from Louisville.
Right.
I was smiling at people and then wondering why they were following me. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like, yeah.
What is that like, Carrie? I mean, this is... The question is going to sound weird, but as a big guy coming to Los Angeles into a city, having been around nightclubs and everything, I guess there was a certain way you can carry yourself, a certain way you can approach a city, which is kind of like, all right, I've been around though. I mean, I'm in town here, but I can play ice hockey. You know,
I've thrown
an elbow. What is it like to come into such a... Well, I don't mean to be disrespectful against Los Angeles, but it's filled with a lot of people, kind of scuzzy people.
Yeah.
As a very pretty girl with $800 who just got off a bus.
That's like they make movies out of that, don't they?
They really do. I mean, you were that girl.
That end well and don't end well.
Right. Well, you're just
a very
pretty young girl full of energy and excitement and vivacity.
Smiling at everybody.
Smiling at everybody because I'm going to be an actress and everything. And my goodness, it's like being thrown into, into the dark star or something.
Yeah.
It's being thrown into the dark side of the force. I mean, how How do you get through that with the guys following you and with all that stuff?
I mean, you figure it out really quickly. You know, it's like that whole you're not in Kansas anymore. I mean, you figure it out. And then, you know, like I said, I had some place I could stay for 2 weeks. So I quickly got a temp job, and then I got another job waiting tables. So I was working temp during the day, and then I was waiting tables at night. And you start to make friends, and then you find people who are also wanting to be actors. And I got I saved up enough money, and I started taking class at the Groundlings. And so you find people who want to be actors too, and so they let you know what's going on, and then you quickly find a community, and that's, you know, that's what you do. So like when people call me, you know, because my mom is very good about giving my number to people who want to come to Los Angeles and, you know, become actors. You know, I say to them, if you want to do it, you have to find a community quickly. And that means getting in class, you know, and just doing that. So that's what I did.
How was the Groundlings for you?
It was really fun. I had a great time. And then I met some people, and we started a small little improv company. And then with that company, we met a guy, this guy, Dan O'Connor, who was starting a company called Theater Sports, which is improvisational comedy done as like a sporting event. Mm-hmm. And he got our company involved. And this is when, gosh, we were all like 25, 26. And we started this company. And we started in Hollywood at the Theater, which used to be...
I remember Theater, sure.
It's a great old theater. And we didn't know what we were doing, and we just started this, and we did really well. It was really fun. We were there for years and years and years and years.
Yeah, I didn't know that you were. Yeah, you that was a very, very early in the life of improv and improv theaters in Los Angeles.
Yeah, yeah.
Was Theater Sports and of course Off the Groundlings,
right?
Who had their and still have their training regimen and classes and everything. They have a pretty big, nice theater there on Melrose.
Yeah.
So when did you start getting work or an agent or anything? Did you start
working
pretty quickly in commercials for chewing gum?
Yeah, it was commercials. Commercials. I was pretty lucky to land a commercial agent and then got a commercial pretty quickly, which let me into the union because it's that catch-22 of how to get in the union. And then from that, I got a bigger commercial agency. So I was able to start working like that pretty quickly. And then I got my first pilot when I was like... Was I 26? Yeah, I think it was 26. And it was a sketch comedy show called Dates from Hell or Adventures from Romance. It was for Fox. Didn't get picked up. Your friend Brian Briggins was in it.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and David Gennellari was the exec on that. So that was my first job. So, and then from there, after I landed that, and I had been working, like I said, at PolyGram Records. And the guy that I was working for is this really cool guy. His name's Steve McKeever. And he now owns Hidden Beach Records, which is a very... He's got Jill Scott and all that on there. It's very cool. But he was getting ready to go to Motown. And he said, do you want to come with me? And I went, wow, this could be like a whole thing. Like maybe I'd go in the music business because it was very interesting and exciting. But right at that time, I landed that pilot. And I went, okay, no, this is really what I want to do. So I said no to that and quit all my jobs and did this pilot, and I went, okay, no looking back now. So I am going to be an actor, and if I have to ever support myself on something else, I got to rethink it because, you know, it's a sticky trap you get stuck in. You know, like I was waiting table with people who were, you know, in their 40s who were still trying to be an actor. And I was like, okay, cause it's enticing. I guess it's like those dreams of the presidency, you know, they die hard. So,
well, I think that's really true. And I've described it as like, it's very hard to walk away from the jackpot wheel.
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you've got a place at the wheel, even if your little nail in the wheel, that clicker, is so small, almost nobody walks away from it.
Yeah.
Because it just keeps spinning. Well, I'll stand here. I'll spin again.
Yeah,
I'll spin
yeah.
again.
Yeah.
But what in your preparation as an actress do you think helped you with those early jobs you were getting or did anything?
You know,
did you find studying a lot helped you, or did you find it was useful in creating a community, but that, you know, when push came to shove, it was just instinctive?
Well, I mean, a lot of stuff is instinctive. You know, actors are different. Everybody works differently. Like, you know, my husband works very differently than I do. And for me, because I started so heavily in the improvisational world, you know, in improv theater and all that, and now I still have my improv company. We've been together forever. We're doing these long form things now that are kind of fun, these Jane Austen plays and things like that. for me, I like to get in it and then find out what we've got going on. Do you know what I mean? Where other people, they like to write everything down and they study and they do all that stuff. I can do a little bit of that, you know, and that was from all my training back in college and all that mm-hmm. stuff. But I really like to get in it and then, you know.
Just kind of get it on its feet.
Get it on its feet.
With the people that are in it. Let's just go through it and sort of see what happens.
See what we've got going on.
And we'll certainly have ideas from there.
Yeah. So, you know, in that sense, all the improv stuff has just been invaluable. It's been invaluable for me. So, you know, because it helps you when you audition. It helps you on the set. It just helps you everywhere. It gives you, you know, I don't know. It makes you feel like, okay, no matter what comes, I can throw it back. You know, I can right. I can hit the ball. It'll be okay.
And your husband, would you please, your husband Kyle, a wonderful guy, who works quite a bit in the industry.
Yes.
Did he have a different acting approach to you?
He's very much, I mean, he used to, you know, he's
or
a
I
funny...
I should have him on the podcast.
That's right.
You
can talk to him about his acting approach.
Sorry.
Yes. He came from dramas a lot. You know, he's a funny guy, but he mostly did dramas. Mm-hmm. And he's just a different kind of actor. He's, you know, it's so funny. Just the way he works is just different than the way I work. Just different.
How long have you guys been married?
10 years.
10 years.
Going to be 11 in January.
And it's great. And you get along famously. And you're both great people.
Thank you.
How has that been difficult, that whole two-actor thing that everyone thinks is impossible? Now, my wife is not an actress. We've been married a very long time. But you know, that thing where everyone's, it's impossible. I remember years ago, maybe I was in my early 20s, and, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking about getting married, but Frank Langella was on a talk show. And they had asked him about his wife, and I suppose he was recently divorced from her. I said, well, that didn't exactly work out. I said, oh, I'm sorry. What was easy? And he said, you know, I'm at the point in my life where I think that in they don't make a big enough mirror for the house of two actors. And I think that's generally the problem. Do you guys both? Do you guys have individual small mirrors, and that's cool?
Yes, we do. We have our own. We have our own mirrors. Yeah. No.
But you know what I'm talking about.
No, I just...
But you guys don't seem like you would... You know, you seem like both normal people who happen to act, which is an unusual thing to do for a living, but it's a job.
It's true. It is true. Yeah. The great thing about us both being actors is that we can be around with the kids. And because, you know, if either one of us had a job that was, you know, all-encompassing, like a 9-to-5 kind of thing, it's like they do that schedule, which a lot of people do.
Right.
Where Kyle, when he's working... He's gone for a while, but then he's back for a while. And the same with me. When I'm working, the kids don't see me very much. But then when I'm not working, they see me all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I have been able to so far schedule it so that if I have a job, basically he's not working. So he's around. And then vice versa. So it's been terrific for us. You know, it's been it's been a good thing.
So you were working. What a fascinating aspect of your life for me is that you're working as an actress. Very consistently. And then you decide, I suppose, to try to become a member of the cast of the Penn & Teller show.
Oh. I didn't decide to become a member of the Penn & Teller.
Well, what? I don't know. Well, then, you decided that that would be okay to do something that was quite out of the ordinary for you. Something that you hadn't done before. I'll let you describe.
No, but here's what happened.
What did I do that was wrong?
No,
I apologize. I got a podcast of merit. I said something wrong.
No. It's very funny because I did. It isn't like I went into this saying, "Oh, I'd like to become a fire eater." It happened gradually in steps.
You were attracted by matches, sort of
right
a
thing,
pyromania.
Right,
just that interest kind of builds.
No. So. I was hired by them to do a sketch show that they...
improv led you to that. Okay.
Well, it was a written thing that they had written. And they needed an actor and an actress to help fill out these sketches that they'd done. And it was called Phobophilia, it's the fear of fear. And so all these sketches were about different types of fear. And they hired me to do that. And I had never seen their show live before. So I went to Las Vegas to see it. And Penn does this amazing thing where it's a two-person fire eating routine. And he was doing it with this, her name is Georgie, and she's a showgirl. It's beautiful, like, you know, tall and amazing and all that. And I watch and I'm like, wow, that is just so cool. Because it's two people like they're on a date kind of thing. And I thought, you know, that's just such a great piece of theater. And I would love to just, you know, it would just be such a cool thing to do. So I told Pan, I said, if, you know, Georgie ever leaves or she can't do it or something, and I can learn it, I would love to do that. Well, sure enough, Georgie got a job someplace else. And so she couldn't be there. So he said, did you mean it? And I was like, yes. So I went to Las Vegas and I had to learn how to eat fire first, of course. So,
well, can we just, like, what, when you're in the audience, you know, that is, I think you would have to admit, kind of an unusual impulse that the fire-eating woman, like, not only am I enjoying this or seeing the how good it is as theater, but boy, if she doesn't want to do that, I would love to do that.
It was just cool. It was just really cool. I've never seen anything like it. So, yeah. But the thing is when I learned to actually eat fire, right, I mean, there's all these rules, of course, that you have to do to keep yourself safe. But at one point, when you practice with there's the swabbing on the end of the wire, and you practice it dry, you know, kind of thing, and then you learn it's all about, you know, you gotta just have to learn how to do it. But Penn said, he said, this is kind of the moment of truth. You can either do it or you can't, because it's incredibly counterintuitive to put fire in your face. So, you know, so he lit the thing on fire and I picked it up and I went to, you know, extinguish it, like to put it in my mouth like that. And I went and I put it down. I was like, I can't do this. And then he looked at me and he goes, well, and then I'm like, oh no, I can do this. So then I just like did it. And I went, oh my gosh, I just did it. I just did it. Yeah. So then once you learn the skills of the fire eating stuff, then we had to learn the routine, which is this, like I said, it's just fun where you're dipping your swab in the champagne flute of lighter fluid, and then you're setting them on fire, and then you're crossing arms together and you're putting them out like this. And so, yeah, it was
so
really
Penn
fun.
Taught you fire eating. I mean, he was the person. You had to show up at his house or something, and
not at his house.
Well, backstage at the theater.
No, they have like an office studio place. Yes,
the office studio place.
Yes,
in order to learn the fire eating.
Yes. Yeah.
How long does it take? Is it like a one day thing? You get over your fear of it. You just start doing it.
Yes.
And then
once
you're done with the fire eating itself, the physical thing, then we learn the sketch.
Right. Right, yes. And, you know, you get burned. You get little burns on the inside of your mouth and stuff like that. So,
is that throughout the run?
Oh, yeah.
Like
always? Yeah. So it was funny because I was doing, at one point, what happened is once I started doing the show is that I would do the show and then I would fly back here if I was working. So I was doing an episode of Grace Under Fire, oddly enough. And so I was like a rock star. I would finish the show in Vegas and jump on a flight. And like there was a 1 o'clock flight you could get on, come back here. Catch a cab back to the house, sleep, go to the studio and, you know, rehearse for Grace Under Fire, get done, jump on a plane in Burbank at 5:45 or whatever, get to Vegas, get in the cab, run, and, you know, my dresser would be meeting me at the door, you know, and I'd be putting my makeup on the plane, and I'd jump into my dress and stuff, and then go on stage, and then finish, get back on the plane, come back here. It was kind of fun. So
that was crazy. That's like that, you know, like Orson Welles' old-time show biz of doing coast-to-coast things or whatever.
Yeah. Well, Las Vegas is kind of like that. I mean, I haven't been there in forever, so I don't know if it's still like that. But at the time, you know, it was very much like that, like old kind of show-busy vibe. But, you know, you'd get done. If I didn't have to come back to L.A., I'd stay out there. And so if you get done with the show and you go out and have dinner at 10, and then you'd, you know, go and hear really good music at 2 o'clock in the morning because that's when all the session guys had gotten done or all the great musicians had gotten done with their gigs, and then they got together someplace else to play together, you know, for fun. So, you know, and then you go to bed at like 5 or 6 in the morning. So, you know, it was a fun time. And we were playing at Bally's, and I had Dean Martin's old dressing room. At Bally's, so that was kind of cool. And my dresser, her name, what's her name? I don't remember. She'd been around forever in Las Vegas, and she had all these great stories of old Las Vegas. And so when I was getting ready and getting, you know, into my costume, and she was helping me and all that stuff, I was like trying to get you know stories out of her and stuff. So she told this great Dean Martin story of she was in Shirley MacLaine was playing, so she's getting Shirley MacLaine's next costume stuff ready, and she hears this terrific commotion out in the hallway. She goes out in the hallway and it's Dean Martin, and he's gotten there. You can in Bally's there's you can get from the casino backstage. There's a door. You just have to know where it is. So he'd gotten backstage and he was in the hallway, and he had fallen into a wardrobe, you know, a rack of clothing, and he was standing up and he was, you know, drunk. He's like, what's going, you know, and she comes up to him and she says, Mr. Martin, can I help you? He says, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, get back to the casino. And she said, well, let me help you. And so she takes his arm and she's walking by. But to get to the door to the casino, you have to go by the actual stage entrance, you know, the side stage entrance. And he says, hey, who's on? Who's on stage? And she says, oh, it's Shirley MacLaine. She's like, I know Shirley. I'm going to come and say hello. And she says, no, Mr. Martin, you probably shouldn't. And he says, oh, come on. God, she loves me. I'm going to go say hello. So he walks. He gets away from her. He walks up on stage, right? Shirley MacLaine's in the middle of singing. He walks onto the stage. They hit him with the spotlight. He says, don't mind me. I'm drunk. Standing ovation.
Right.
Standing ovation. Just for saying that.
Don't mind me. I'm drunk.
Standing ovation.
Yeah. Las Vegas.
Yeah. Did you like my Dean Martin impression,
by
the way?
That was very good. It was a really good Dean Martin.
Yeah. Yeah.
How long did you do that gig?
A couple years. Just a couple years.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
2 years?
Yeah. Yeah. But they weren't playing, like now they play nonstop in Vegas, the two of them. But at the time I was just going whenever they would play.
So, in Las Vegas, but you didn't go on the road with them to where Chicago or where?
No. I just did just
2 years.
Vegas.
Did the bit end and Penn didn't want to do it anymore? Or did you say, I think this has been an interesting off ramp that I took, and I think, you know, that's about it for fire eating?
No, they changed the shows around and things like that a lot. So, you know, they just changed it, and I don't know if he's done it since then. He probably has. Probably has some, I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out.
At the 2 year point, how many fire eating shows do you not kind of feel like doing?
How much fuel have you ingested at that point?
Exactly. Like, I mean, does it get to be
maybe not.
I've eaten a lot of fire now.
Maybe
and,
I might be done.
I think this experiment has been wonderful.
I'm going to hang up
I'm done. Or were you really, you were going for it, huh?
Yeah, no, it was just really fun. It was super fun. I mean, we played Las Vegas, and I tell you, I've done, a lot of live theater and a lot of shows. And we used to play the clubs here. We played the Laugh Factory and stuff like that. And, where you're on stage and you're asking for a suggestion. They're like, you're a lesbian. Thank you. Okay. Yes, kiss that other girl. All right. Thank you.
The Sunset Boulevard audience is so imaginative, really. Everything. If I ask, give me an occupation. Gynecologist.
Right. Yeah. So playing a huge theater like that, and I don't remember how many seats it was, 800 seats, maybe more, and the bit, I would be sitting on the couch and the music would start and the curtain would come up and they would push me out, right? And as I was sitting on the couch and I would hear the music start, and the stagehands and I had always had a bit, like you do like the same thing every time, and you sit down and do the thing, and they were pushing me out and the curtain would come up. And the lights, for a minute, the stage lights blind you, right? Because they're at the foot of their footlights, and they blind you. And as the curtain's coming up, you can just feel the audience. You can feel that big crowd. You can hear them. And then it gets up all the way, and you can see, and you can just start to see the sea of people. And it's just, it's amazing. It's just amazing. And, the first time I did it, I was really nervous. And I thought, come on, Carrie, you've been doing this forever. It's no big deal. And I was shaking. My hand was shaking. And I went, oh, I can't shake. I have to eat fire. And it's like, this is going to be a problem.
Right.
And Penn had always told me, he said, look, if something happens, they wait off the wings with fire extinguishers and, wet stuff and things like that. Because he said, but you have 5 seconds or 10 seconds, he said, that you just have to be cool so they can get to you, kind of thing. Yeah. So, you're as safe as you can be, but I was like, so I had the shakes. I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, okay, breathe. And then it was fine and we did it. But I also learned sometimes when you're performing, you get nervous, you try to push for laughs or you try to like do something to get a laugh because it makes you feel better, So I found myself playing the scene a little bit too much, like playing with the audience to try to get like a bit of a laugh. And then I realized it's like, no. This is totally different than just being out there and performing like I'm used to. You have to do this thing. This is like you have a fire eating bit to do. You have a routine to hit. So it's like you had to do that first, and then on top of that, you can do the acting and all that. So it was exactly completely opposite from what I used to do, which is hang on while I take the squeaky toy away from the dog.
The dog has a squeaky toy. It's okay.
No,
it's all right, buddy.
It's all right. It's all right. So that was a whole different skill that I had to learn in front of an audience. It's like, okay, it's not, this is first. You have to be able to do the trick
the technical
thing.
Technical aspects of the trick
are first. And then
everything else comes after the technical eating fire, because you're dealing with fire.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
So
Have you performed for other big crowds like that and other things, or really went back to the theater sports, back to the improv sketch?
Well, we
kind
do
of stuff in small.
This my company. We've been together for over 20 years now, and we play theaters now. So we're about to start a run actually at the Pasadena Playhouse, but we've been at the Broad and we've been at the Odyssey. And
really?
Yeah. So that's what we do.
And it's theater sports.
No. It's called Impro Theater.
Oh, and, Impro Theater.
Yeah. And we do the plays. We do improvised plays. We do Jane Austen.
Oh, okay.
And we do
so the entire
Chekhov
play.
And, yeah. With costumes
improvised.
And all that. And
is
it's
there
great
a website
fun.
That people can look up?
Yeah, it's impro.com. I-M-P-R-O. Oh, no, I think it's Impro Theater. I-M-P-R-O-T-H-E-A-T-R-E.
R-E, because you're artsy.
Because we are, yes.
How come all of actors, we all spell it that way?
I know.
Everyone else spells theater with the
T-E-R, yeah.
And actors spell it T-R-E.
Yeah, just because, you know. Whatever.
Impro Theater.
Yes.
And, well, that's great. Yeah. So now...
Yes.
Here we are now, yes. After an illustrious career.
Yes.
2 years of fire eating. Has anything else struck your fancy like the fire eating? Have you seen, you know, I mean, because that's, as I said, you know, an out of the ordinary thing to say, boy, that's something I would like to do. Have you seen something else?
You know.
That either you've done or just, you know, maybe go toward.
You know, motherhood was pretty, something
pretty
to
major,
take on, yes.
Pretty major.
No. You know.
And you gave up after 2 years on that as well.
That's right. I'm like, yeah, forget it. Yeah. No. The thing about being an actor that's so cool, you never know what's coming. You just don't know what's coming. I mean, years ago I did a dinosaur movie. It was an IMAX dinosaur movie. And I had to learn to rock climb. And in the audition, the director said to me, he goes, how's your fear level? And I said, I think it's pretty good. He said, because we're going to cast you, and I got to say, I said, whoa. He said, I got to say, no. Here, I'm sorry. That, he said, if we get up to Canada, you know, and we put you on that cliff and you can't get on, it's going to be a real problem. And I'm like, no, I think I'm pretty good. And then I'm going to put the dog outside. Here we go. Come here.
Okay.
Come here. Hang on. It's very exciting. So... You know, you never know what's coming. I mean, in this dinosaur movie, I literally, we were rock climbing on this huge cliff, and then because it was IMAX, they couldn't use a stunt person, and I had to fall down the side of a cliff. So they
couldn't use a stunt person for a fall off a cliff?
Right, because it's IMAX. It's the camera was right on me, because I look up into the camera, and then the stake is supposed to go, and then I was supposed to fall down the cliff, right? And then I don't die. I'm saved by the second stake. So we get to Canada, and the guys who are teaching me to, you know, to rock climber, you know, like, hey, it's going to be fine. It's going to be this and that. However, at night when they're talking, they like to tell horrible stories about people going off the edge and, you know.
Right,
like,
of course.
Yeah, terrible things. But they said, look... You need to tell us how much you weigh and not lie. And I said, why is that? And they said, because we're going to rig it for the right amount of weight. Instead of you lie, you could go too far. I'm like, this is how much I weigh. I'm totally, totally serious. Yeah, but
should have exaggerated. I weigh 320 pounds.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just to make sure. Yeah. But I watched this stunt, you know, and it was literally like they had a bag of sand that weighed as much as I did. And yeah, they said go, and then it released, and there was a bit of a free fall, and then the bungee kicked in, and then you kind of slowed down, but you bungee, but you fell down the side of the cliff. So I was padded up and all that stuff, and I went, you know, I could do this, sure, why not? So we shot it, and I went over the side of the cliff, and they got the camera up on me and all this, and once again, I had the thing of going, I had the trigger lines, so after I finished my line, I knew that was the cue that they were going to pop the thing, and I was going to go. So he gets ready to start action, and I start shaking, right? Because I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm about to fall down the side of a cliff, you know? So I was like, okay, breathe. Once again, it's that whole thing of breathe. And I'm like, all right, this is going to be all right. I can do this. So I said my line, Dr. So-and-so, whatever, I'm going to go up now. And then click, it goes. And then boom, I was like free falling for a minute. I was like, wow. And then the bungee kicked in, and I kind of slammed against the side of the mountain for a bit, but I had padding on, and then came all the way down. And it was incredibly exhilarating. And now I know why some people do it. You get that high. You're like, whoa, that was amazing. You just kind of feel like you're invincible. So it was cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's all right.
The dog. The dog adding.
We've had a puppy. Yes. You have the... Hey, this dog isn't as loud as Mark Hamill's dog.
Oh.
Okay. So, well,
see,
okay.
Trying.
That was loud.
Trying. Yes. trying. Yes.
No, we're okay. Fine, buddy. We're fine. Yes. We're good.
Yes, yes.
You can throw him a toy if you want. All right, it's over, you know.
Yeah. All right.
It's not that
squeaky. But anyway, yeah. So, I don't know. Yeah, you don't know what's coming. You know, and I guess if you have that attitude of like I can do it, then things kind of tend to come your way.
An actress of your experience, talent, and age at this point.
Yes.
What do you find you're playing most now?
Moms. I was telling somebody there's like an evolution that you have as an actress. You start. Okay, this squeaking's gonna make me.
Wow.
All right, there he goes. I started my career playing characters that giggled a lot. You know, I was doing sitcoms, so it was a lot of and not wearing a lot of clothes. And I would get picked up by whoever was the star of the show. It would picked up and, you know, we'd go, that was the episode of going home and doing whatever and the silly hijinks that happened. So I started doing that. And then you move into kind of wife. So you go from being the girlfriend or the giggly whatever into the wife. And then you're the wife for a little bit. And then you become the young mother. So you guys are just having babies and this kind of thing. And then you start to do the professional stuff. That's when the dramas start to open up, you know, where it's like you become the victim of things and terrible things are happening. Or you're on the other side. You're a professional something. And and now I'm like the mom of teenagers, you know, like right. The show that we're doing together. We have two teenage sons. All right. This
is and not a dog. We don't have a dog.
Yeah, we don't have a dog.
In our
show. No, we do not have a dog on our show. Oh, the dog. Oh, see, let's have something else happen.
It's
the
good.
Phone's going to happen.
Good. I think that might be it. Might be Penn.
No, but we. So you. I asked somebody. I when I was doing the show called Judging Amy one time. And very famous actress who was on it and Time Daily, and she said to me, "Well, you're in your victim stage right now on all the dramas," and that's true. I still cry a lot on network dramas.
Oh, you mean as an actress?
Yes, as an actress. Yeah. You know the terrible things are happening on network television, and then she said, "I said, oh really? Well, what happens next?" And she goes, "Oh, you're the CEO." So oh. I guess next after I'm done with the mom, I become the bitchy boss. Maybe that's what happens. Yeah, yeah.
So I'll let you go because the dog is.
No, here.
The dog plays with the
oranges.
With
yeah,
oranges.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, but
very healthy dog.
Yes.
High in vitamin C. Go, buddy. Go get the orange. So I suppose when you meet actresses, when you're talking with those young ladies that your mom gives them up to. Mom's alive and back in Kentucky.
Right.
Her dad?
Yes. No, he passed away a while ago.
God bless the Coast Guard auxiliary.
Yes, the Coast Guard auxiliary.
What do you have to say to those young girls, the pretty young girl full of vivacity and acting talent who's getting out of her car, you know, who's getting out of her car in today's Hollywood and asking you what to do? What do you tell her?
You know, I say unfortunately, there's not a set path. And it's kind of true. You can't give somebody a blueprint and say, follow this and you'll be okay. So I say, if this is your passion and this is your dream, you know, you got to follow it and go for it. And then I'll say what I said to you, get into a class so you can find a community. And you know, you kind of try to find your niche, kind of find what you're good at, you know, what you can do that you go, okay, I have this in my back pocket that I know this is my strength. And, yeah. And then, you know, you just have to be true to yourself and, you know, follow your passion because there isn't a 1-2, you know, here you go kind of thing. It's like, you know, you can break in very early in your career. You can have success happen later in your career. You can start doing commercials first. You can find your first job out, you could land a pilot that goes to series and that, you know, you could do movies or you could, you know, plays. Just there's so many different avenues.
Have you had fun?
I have had fun. I have.
It's been worth it?
Yeah, totally. Completely. I've been really, really lucky because I have continued to work and do things that I really find fascinating and been able to do some really great projects and meet some great people and it just keeps going. Everyone says, you know, oh, you kind of tend to hit one thing and then it goes away and, you know, or you'll peak and then you don't get to work anymore. And I've been very fortunate in that I've, you know, been able to continue on. So hopefully that continues.
Well, thanks so much for being on the podcast, Carrie.
Thank you, Tom.
Where can people find you? Facebook, I'm sure.
Yes.
But any other places? Anything? Do you Twitter? Do you do any of that stuff?
I don't.
You don't? Do you have a website?
Yeah. No.
Boy,
I know.
Lucky. I know. No, I mean, that's good.
I know. Yeah.
That's good. That you, well, you know, have a Facebook and that's people can find you, but you're everything. You're working enough. And you don't know Fire Eater?
No, yeah. There's no stuff, Fire Eater, no. The club, we all get together.
Yeah, right.
Just, you know, put out, extinguish a few flames for fun. Yeah, you know, yeah.
No, well, thank you very much for being on the podcast. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for coming over.
My pleasure. Thanks so much to Carrie Coleman, and thanks to Buddy the dog. Because as it turns out, Buddy kept barking and barking, but we finally looked, and Timmy was trapped in a well. We actually rescued Timmy, thanks to Buddy and his help with the podcast. Thanks to Emily Wilson for producing. Thanks to Chris, Katie, everybody at Nerdist Industries. Thanks to McPherson Guitars for helping me out with my live show. Come check out a live show. I'm fabulous in person. I'm okay. But thanks so much. Tell a friend about the podcast. Would you consider subscribing? But I will talk to you next time. Big Pop Fun out.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.